that we're a conditioned phenomena and what we will become in the future is dependent upon what we're doing now. Let's recall that happiness comes from having wholesome or virtuous motivations and actions. Unhappiness from unwholesome or non-virtuous motivations and actions. And so really feeling some urgency to practice the Dharma, transform our minds. Let's listen and think and contemplate attentively. And let's do this for the long-term purpose of going towards full enlightenment. As a very efficacious and noble way to repay the kindness of others and to be of great benefit to them. Okay, so last year, what I did at the very beginning was to give the five precepts and celibacy for the period of the EML program. So I think that tomorrow we'll do that for the people who don't have the five precepts and celibacy. And so you'll do that for the period of the EML program, so that you'll have the experience of really taking some precepts and keeping them and living in that way. And then at the end of the program, if people want to take the five precepts, the general five precepts, for their whole life, then let me know and then we can do that. Somebody's excited. Okay, so I thought that I'd talk today a little bit about the benefits of precepts and how precepts fit into the overall path of the Dharma. Okay, so I'm assuming everybody has a little bit of the world view of multiple rebirths and us being born again and again in this body and mind that are under the control of ignorance, afflictions, and karma. So I'm kind of assuming that. So I won't go into a great deal of the depth about that right now, although you're welcome to ask questions about it. And so if we think about that as being our situation, then we wonder how to get out of it. Okay, so if we are living in the midst of the first two noble truths, in other words, dukkha, or unsatisfactory conditions, and the causes of them which exist, or their origins which exist within our own mind, beginning with ignorance and then proliferating into a whole bunch of other afflictions after that, and then under the influence of afflictions creating karma, and then the karma meaning actions of body, speech, and mind. And then those actions being a conditioning factor, strong conditioning factor, in what we experience. In other words, what we're born as, the events that happen to us when we're alive, our habitual patterns of acting and thinking, and the environment in which we're born into. So if we see this as quite a dire situation, that basically we're control freaks that have no control. Yeah? We want to be able to control everything, and yet, you know, did we control this rebirth? Yeah. Did you choose to be born? Do you remember having a conscious choice to take a body that gets old and sick and dies? No. How many things in our life do we really have control over? Just takes a few minutes of trying to watch the breath, and we see we have very little control over our mind. We have little control over our body. It gets old and sick and dies all by itself, even though we try and prevent it. We try and control other people. Mm-hmm. They don't want our control. We try and control the environment, and we wind up destroying it. You know, so when we look at this situation, we have this illusion of control and this craving for control, and yet we have very little control. And in fact, we are the ones who are controlled, and what controls us is principally ignorance, anger, attachment, and then our karma. But then we realize that this is a pretty dire situation. You know, this is not just kind of, when we talk about liberation from this, we're not just talking about, you know, something to do on Sunday mornings. No, we're not just talking about something that after I get done having a good time, I'll get around to liberation. But we really see that this is quite a serious situation, because at any moment we could die. And, you know, if we've lived our life and we see we have very little control, then what's going to happen at the time of death? You know, mine's going to go totally bonkers. And then again, just pushed by the ignorance, afflictions, karma, and pushed into another life. And seeing that this has happened some beginningless time, and there's no sign of it abating, then we begin to have some sense that this is a dangerous situation that we need to pay some attention to and not get us distracted by the illusion of the glitter that we see. Because we do have some quote-unquote happiness, and we get carried away by that happiness, and we think that happiness is going to be our salvation. So if we only have good food, if we only have a family life, if we only have money, if we only have a career, if we only have possessions, if we only have romance, if we only have reputation. So all these things bring some kind of happiness. But if we investigate the nature of that happiness and really look at it seriously and question, is it happiness, then we get a very different take on the situation. So I really recommend that you take out some, and this is why we did the discussion group, because all these things are things that we were taught would make us happy. And to look at them and how much happiness did we receive from them. And how much happiness have the people around us received from having these things. And if all this stuff is the way to actual happiness, why are people experiencing so much misery? And then the big question is, why, if people are miserable, do they keep doing the same old things, thinking that the next time it'll be happiness? And why have these people who are miserable taught us, their children, who they love so much, to seek happiness in these ways, when they themselves have found only limited happiness in these things? And then we really see, you know, that how kind our family is in wishing us well, but how limited their wisdom is and how incapable they are of leading us to happiness, even though that's what they want for us more than anything. And we begin to see that they themselves have limited happiness. Some feeling of success or whatever from this or that, or pleasure from this and that. But, you know, if we talk to any of the people that we hold dear to our hearts, are they looking forward to dying? You know, do they have any sense of confidence when they talk about death? You know? So considering that death is the one thing that we have to do and everything else is optional, you know, these people who care about us and who teach us what they consider to be the way for happiness, even though they've only had limited success with it, you know, that at the end of the day it leaves them and us in, you know, completely at a loss of what to do when we're dying, when we have to separate from all these things. Okay? So, in, you know, family disintegrates, doesn't it? You know, people die, people get divorced, people stop speaking to each other. Family disintegrates. Career disintegrates. You know? And, you get old after a while and you can't do the same things you did before in your career, and the young upstarts get the better chances and all this kind of stuff. Money comes and goes. Well, romantic life comes and goes. Possessions, you know, at the time of death, you leave them all. All your family members, you leave them all. You know, doesn't matter how much, you know, happiness you've had from romance or from children or whatever, at the time of death, all these are bye-bye. And so what really is important in our life? And this is a very, very important question. And, you know, we've been strongly conditioned by society and by our own previous lives and by our own ignorance. And so we buy into a lot of things that reputedly will bring us joy, but haven't. But it's very scary actually admitting that. Because if we actually admit it, then we might have to, you know, do something different. And change is scary. And separating from the things that we're attached to, even though they lead us to misery, is scary. Isn't that absolutely incredible how scary it is to leave the things that we create negative karma with? To leave the things that are suffering in nature. We're terrified of it, you know? So, you know, to really do some exploration about this situation that we live in. And, you know, you can imagine yourself having this wonderful life. You know, you have the career and you have the loving family and you have the romance. Doesn't matter how many buses come by, if it's one or many. And, you know, you have money and you have possessions and you have acclaim and praise and reputation. And when you die, none of it comes with. And instead, what goes with is our karma and our habitual mental states. Those are the two strongly conditioning things that go with us. But if we've ignored those two things while we've been alive, then the time of death is just total freak-out time. Yeah. And if we were assured a good human life, you know, next lifetime and another opportunity to practice, that's one thing, you know. Okay, mañana a la mañana, next lifetime. Okay, but we don't have that insurance, because we're under the influence of afflictions and karma. And so if we get born in an unfortunate realm, or even as a human being, but somebody who doesn't have contact with the Dharma, or whose mind is, whose senses don't work properly, or whose mind is overwhelmed by wrong views, or any, or, you know, born in a place where there's no Dharma, or who knows what. Even we have that kind of rebirth, which are the majority, which is the majority of rebirths that sentient beings take, then what are we going to do? Yeah. I mean, Achala and Manjushri live in a monastery. Yeah. But do they have a chance to practice the Dharma? No. Okay. So, we have to think about these things and not just get sunk in the feeling that I am this lifetime, or the feeling that I am who I am right now. Because right now we're comparatively healthy and our senses function and da 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 da. But you know, it just takes one car accident. Yeah, it takes, you know, all sorts of people have heart attacks when they're young, or brain aneurysms, or who knows what. And then the whole opportunity is bye-bye. And there's no chance, there's no second chance. Yeah. We can't get to our deathbed, or we can't get to the point where we're physically or mentally incapacitated and then say, oh, excuse me, I want to rerun the time machine and make a different decision about how to live my life. Yeah, there's no possibility. The time is just going forward and we're carried by the impetus of afflictions and karma. And so that's why it's very important to make good choices in our life. So if we get interested in liberation and being free of this situation, then, and we see that the ignorance grasping at true existence is the source of all the afflictions and karma, then we want to question if this ignorance can be eliminated. And we find out that yes, it can, because the object of this ignorance, true existence, does not exist at all. And if we're able to generate the wisdom that realizes the emptiness of true existence, then we can cut this wisdom from its root and attain liberation. If we, you know, we get some confidence in this. Okay, so it comes back to having confidence in emptiness. And then from that, the question comes, well, how do we develop this wisdom that realizes emptiness? What's the path that we have to practice, that we have to actualize, that will bring the result of the cessation of suffering, of the cessation of dukkha and its origins? And if we have compassion for other sentient beings and want them to be free of samsara as well, then what is the path that we practice that will bring about the full enlightenment so that we can really be of the utmost benefit? Okay. And so there, that's when the Buddha taught the three higher trainings, okay, as the path that will lead us ultimately to the realization of the ultimate nature of phenomena, which will cut the ignorance, which stops the afflictions and the karma, which will prevent rebirth and samsara, and instead enable us to abide in a state of liberation, of peace, or a state of enlightenment, where we have peace not only for ourselves, but also the ability to be of the greatest benefit to others. Okay, so that path, the three higher trainings, okay, higher training of ethics, ethical conduct, higher training of concentration, higher training of wisdom. Okay, it's the higher training of wisdom that actually realizes suchness, as the way things actually exist. So the higher training of wisdom is the actual thing that we want to develop that's going to cut the root of samsara. Okay, now how do we develop that wisdom? it isn't by sitting there and praying, Buddha, please grant me wisdom. And it isn't by going to college and studying all the textbooks. Okay? And it isn't by, you know, doing any number of things that we might think. So the way of generating wisdom is, you know, we have to hear teachings, we have to contemplate them, we have to meditate on them. And so we need the correct view of how things exist. And we also need the concentration that can keep the mind focused on that view so that the wisdom is powerful. Because if we may have the understanding of things not being being empty of true existence, but if our mind is scattered, then the mind has no power and force, the wisdom has no power and force to be able to systematically familiarize itself with this view of emptiness and therefore cut the afflictions, all the various levels and degrees of afflictions. So it's not that you realize emptiness once for a split second and all the origins of samsara disappear. You know, we have to really meditate on it for quite a long time. So the concentration is quite important. Okay. How are we going to learn to concentrate? If for wisdom we need concentration, how are we going to develop the concentration? Again, it's not by watching TV. It's not by praying to the Buddha to give us concentration. It's not by staring at candles. Okay. It's by, you know, hearing, meditating, and thinking about meditating on the teachings of how to develop concentration and samadhi. And one of the prerequisites for the development of concentration is ethical conduct. Okay. Why is ethical conduct a prerequisite for concentration, which is needed for wisdom? Ethical conduct, basically to put it in modern terms, means getting your life together. It's nothing more than getting your life together. If we don't have our life together, if our mind is constantly distracted, if our mind is totally involved in negativities, how in the world are we going to develop concentration? Yeah? Even if our mind just is any impulse that comes into the mind, we follow it. So we have no ethical discipline. How are we going to be able to pacify the mind enough to develop concentration? Yeah. So people who think, oh, ethical discipline, that's just prudish, and, you know, we don't need that, I'm going to be a great yogi. They really don't understand very well how the mind works. Because if we act destructively, we're going to be filled with regret and guilt, which are going to be huge distractions for developing concentration. Okay? Also, how ethical conduct fits into this is there's stages of subduing the mind. Of course, you know, the wisdom realizing emptiness is the thing that's going to subdue the afflictions completely by eradicating them from the root so that they can never reappear. Concentration subdues the gross afflictions. Okay, because when you're able to concentrate the mind single-pointedly, then the gross afflictions can't manifest. They haven't been uprooted because the mind doesn't necessarily have the wisdom realizing suchness. But at least during the time of deep samadhi, the gross afflictions aren't there, so the mind is pacified somewhat. To develop that ability to pacify the mind and the gross level of afflictions, don't we need first the ability to pacify the even grosser level of afflictions that cause us to act harmfully? Don't we first need to pacify the very gross destructive actions of body and speech? Okay? So that way you can see, you know, how if we want the ultimate subduing of the afflictions from wisdom, we need the concentration which can subdue the manifest afflictions. And to have that, we need the ethical discipline that can subdue the very gross negativities of body and speech. Okay, so ethical conduct is really the foundation of what we're doing. And ethical conduct is one of the first things we do to try and put our life together. Because, again, if we look in our life and we look at the things that we feel the worst about having done in our lives, okay, when you look at those things or the times in your life where you were the most unhappy and the most confused and having the most problems, wasn't there usually some aspect of mushy, messy ethical conduct involved at that time? Yeah? Either taking drugs or drinking too much or having multiple relationships or stealing or engaging in wrong livelihood or lying or getting angry all the time and speaking harsh words or divisive words. All those times in our life where we've had incredible problems, yeah? If we look, there's usually some aspect of ethical conduct that we were neglecting at that time. Okay? So, we can begin to see that ethical conduct is pretty important. Okay? It's important not only to be able to generate concentration and wisdom, but it's also important to be able to generate bodhicitta, because bodhicitta is, you know, the wish to attain Buddhahood for the benefit of others. Bodhicitta is dependent upon great compassion. Compassion wants sentient beings to be free of suffering. Sloppy ethical discipline doesn't care whether sentient beings are suffering or not. How can we generate bodhicitta, which wants them to be free of suffering, if we don't care beans enough about their suffering to control our own negative actions that directly cause them misery? Do you get what I mean? Yeah? So saying, I'm going to be a great bodhisattva, but ethical conduct is old-fashioned, I don't need it. How are we going to stop? How are we going to benefit others if we can't stop harming them first? You know, it doesn't make any sense. So ethical conduct is, you know, important for to generate the wisdom aspect of the path. It's important to generate bodhicitta, which is the method aspect of the path. Ethical conduct is important to generate concentration. It's necessary just to get along with people in our own lives. And it's necessary in order to have a happy life this lifetime. Don't you agree? Mm-hmm. Yeah? And so people may be rich or famous or have reputation and get it through unethical means. And they may have what we were talking about, the show of being happy and having a good reputation and having this and that. But everybody, you know, when we go to bed at night, we have to live with ourselves, don't we? And we know what we've done and what we haven't done. So even just on the level of being peaceful and content in this life, ethical conduct is so important. And also, if we're always saying the world's going to hell, well, the main source of it is unethical conduct, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we sit and look at the 6 o'clock news and what people are doing and the wars and the scandals, and it's all because people aren't keeping ethical conduct. It's very clear. Yeah, isn't it? Yeah, you just look at the 6 o'clock news. It's all about people not keeping ethical conduct, and the result that comes in this life from that, let alone the result that comes in future lives for it. Okay, so ethical conduct, what's the relationship between precepts and ethical conduct? Okay, so ethical conduct means that we've chosen not to act negatively. Yeah, ethical conduct isn't just not acting negatively, because, you know, you could be asleep and not acting negatively, you know, not doing destructive actions. Or you could, you know, be doped up and not doing a lot of negative actions. That's not ethical conduct, okay? Ethical conduct really depends upon the intention, having a clear, focused intention to abandon harmful actions. And so here's the value of taking the precepts, because when we take precepts, we are generating that clear intention to abandon certain unethical actions. Okay? Or we're making the clear intention not to do certain actions that could lead us to getting involved in unethical actions. Because there's different kinds of precepts. Some precepts counteract naturally negative actions, and some precepts involve stopping behavior that isn't naturally negative by itself, but it's the Buddha established these precepts to keep us from going near situations like that. Okay? So, you know, really keeping ethical conduct involves having that intention. Now, as a lay practitioner, you can take the 5 precepts and you have the intentions not to do those 5 actions. Okay? As a monastic, you have many more precepts. So your life is more circumscribed. The precepts, most of them are branches. Not all, but most of them are branches of the 5 precepts. So you're made more aware of negative actions and how to avoid them. And you're setting a clearer intention to avoid them. And every moment that you are not doing a negative action, you are accumulating virtue. Okay, so this is the difference between somebody who's taken a precept and somebody who hasn't. And this includes, you know, taking the 5 precepts versus not taking them, is that, for example, 2 people could be sitting here in this room. Neither one of them is actively committing the action of killing right now. Okay? The person who has precepts is accumulating good karma, is accumulating virtue by not killing right now, because they have the intention not to kill right now, even though the intention may not be manifest, it's there in their body, you know, in their mind. Whereas the person who doesn't have the precepts is not accumulating that good karma, because there's no clear intention not to do this that negative action. Okay? So taking precepts enables you to be more mindful about your behavior. And it enables you to stop bad behavior before doing it and to accumulate a lot of good karma, even by, you know, whether you're sleeping or just walking around or whatever, because of the value of having that intention not to do those harmful actions. Okay? So monastic precepts in particular, what's the difference between taking the five lay precepts and taking monastic precepts. Like I mentioned, the five lay precepts are more general, okay? And also they're looser, okay? The monastic precepts are much more pointed, much more detailed. So we come to look at our actions much more closely through the monastic precepts. Also, when you are a monastic and when you wear robes, yeah, people notice your behavior more. Yeah. As we noticed yesterday, we're all scared about what other people are going to think about us. Now here is where that attachment to reputation could potentially be useful. Is, you know, if I'm a monastic and I misbehave, people are not going to think well of me. And, if you really want to make that virtuous, and my misbehavior will adversely affect them having faith in the three jewels. And I don't want to adversely affect other living beings' faith in the three jewels. And if I act ridiculously, it also displays my own lack of integrity and my own lack of commitment to the path. And I really want to be somebody with integrity and commitment to the path. So wearing robes constantly reminds you of your precepts, you know, because other people are going to notice how you act. And you're going to notice how you act, you know. If you lie and then you look at these robes, you know, then you feel, ugh, you know, these robes don't stand for lying. They stand for telling the truth. What did I just do? I need to clean up my act. Okay? So, you know, having that kind of awareness is actually quite good for you. It's, some people feel very self-conscious, like, everybody's looking at me because I have robes on and I don't like everybody looking at me. Yeah. But if you think about it in a different way, that kind of self-consciousness is just rubbish samsara mind. Okay. But if you look at it another way, like, you know, other people are looking at what I'm doing, and I want to behave with integrity, and I want to behave with consideration for how my actions are going to affect them, then I need to be careful. Yeah? And so then that automatically helps us to restrain from negative action. Okay? Because you see, when you're a lay person, you can do whatever you want, and nobody, you know, thinks twice about it, you know, unless they take you to court for something. Yeah? But, you know, you just do whatever you want in a public place, and people go, oh, it's just a drunk guy, or that's a guy, that's just somebody who's lying, or, you know, that person's cheating on their partner, or, you know, that person's just terrorizing the office with all their gossip. You know, people will just think like that. But, you know, kind of, you know, you can do what you want. You know, if you want to sit around all day and watch television, you can do it. If you want to drink and drug, you can do it. You know, if you want to surf the internet and look at all the porn sites, you can do it. You know, nobody's really going to care very much, and nobody's going to notice it very much. You know, if you want to overeat, nobody's going to care. If you want to shoplift, you know, just don't get caught. You know, so you have this certain kind of anonymity when you're a lay person. When you're monastic, you don't. And that actually, you know, if we're really caring about our ability to practice the path, that lack of anonymity really works to our own benefit. Doesn't it? Because it makes us wake up. Yeah. So that can be quite good for us, I think. Mm-hmm. Also, when you're wearing the robes, it reminds you every day of what your purpose in life is. When you wear lay clothes, your clothes don't, you know, if you put on a doctor's white jacket, maybe fat, or, you know, a suit and tie, something, but, you know, it doesn't really remind you of your purpose in life, does it? And our clothing is usually done out of ego thing, you know, how can I wear nice looking clothing so that people will respect me? You know, you are what you wear, and so you have to wear the right kind of clothing for the right kind of situation, because your reputation is going to depend upon that. Okay, so you get into that whole ballgame. Now, when you wear robes, it's, you know, you're aware all the time of what you have chosen to make the most meaningful thing in your life. When you're a lay person, you know, whether Dharma is the most meaningful thing in your life or not is completely up to you inwardly. Nobody's going to say anything about it outwardly, anything like that. So actually, it's much more difficult. Much more difficult, I think. Yeah. Because when you're a lay person, you know, the thought comes in the mind, oh, I can sleep with that person, situation looks good, nobody's going to find out, my spouse doesn't know, boing, you're in bed. You know, when you're monastic, you better think twice about that, you know, because you got to live with yourself because you're going to put these robes on, and you got to live with other people who are going to see you doing that. Yeah, so it really, ooh, better restrain, I'm not going to act out that thought. So it's really very much for our own benefit, okay? So I say this because it came up a little bit yesterday. People were asking, you know, difference between a lay life and a monastic life. I actually think living as a lay practitioner is much more difficult than being a monastic. Yeah, much more difficult because you have more distractions, you have more social pressure, you don't have the protection of the robes, you know. You have more people who are going to ask you to do all sorts of things, which they wouldn't dare ask a monastic to do. And you don't have the community support to abandon negativities, and you just have a whole access to a whole society, you know, where people speak about ethical conduct but don't necessarily live it. So I think keeping good ethical conduct as a layperson is incredibly difficult. Yeah. And I think subduing your ignorance, anger, and attachment as a layperson is very difficult. So I always find it rather amusing that lay people, you know, look at monastics and say, oh, what you're doing is so hard, I could never do that. Yeah. And you know, from one viewpoint, you can see that. You know, people look and say, wow, you know, you're celibate? I could never be celibate, you know. Or you don't, you know, you're not watching all the TV programs. You don't have a steady income. I could never do that. You know, you don't even drink wine at meals with your family. Oh, I could never do that. You don't buy lottery tickets. Oh, you don't go shopping. You know? So people might look at the monastic life and say, oh, that's so difficult to keep. You know, but that's because people have certain ideas of what they want to do. Okay. As a monastic, you have different ideas of what you want to do. And so, therefore, lay life seems incredibly difficult. You know? Like, how in the world would I live with a man I'm sexually attracted to and not get overwhelmed by attachment? You know? How in the world am I going to do that? And that's why I decided to become a nun, because I knew I couldn't do that. Yeah. How in the world am I gonna, you know, stop being angry at different things if I put myself right in the middle of them, because I'm seeking reputation and glory and everything else, and when I don't get it, I get angry about it. So, no, I mean, I just saw very clearly when I was a layperson, because I had different goals. You know, if you have the goals of an ordinary person, of a layperson who wants that, put it this way, if you have the goals of the happiness of this life, monastic life looks difficult. Okay? So if you want the happiness of this life, monastic life looks like so much suffering to you. No sex, no money, no rock and roll. No music, no dancing, no drugs and alcohol. You know, vegetarian. Actually, that's not included in the monastic vows. But, you know, so there's regulations about all these kinds of things. Whereas if you're somebody who really wants to get out of samsara, and wants to help others get out of samsara, then living as a lay person seems like, at least to me, it seemed like impossible. How am I ever going to get out of samsara if I'm living in that way? Okay. So sure, I could be a wife and a mother, you know, and maybe be able to raise some good kids, but you never know, because the kids you get are, you know, it's potluck, isn't it? Isn't it? You know, you're not screening those beings before this, you know. Hold on, I don't want this mind stream coming in, you know, to the union of sperm and egg that's my kid, you know. I want an interview process here. I'm going to choose the mind stream. I want a kid who's going to listen to me. I want a kid who's going to be good. You know, what do you get? You get who knows what kind of kid. It's true, isn't it? Yeah? You see people who are wonderful parents, and they get kids, mama mia, you know? Because it's really potluck who you get. And your kids come in with their own karma, and they're going to act their own ways, and so you don't know what kind of kids you're going to get and how successful you're going to be in raising that kid. So, you know, you just look at it. And, okay, you know, if I were married and with a husband and with a kid, would I be able to teach the Dharma? You know, maybe after 20 years, if my kids finally grew up and moved out of the house. Yeah, but while they're little, I'm going to be too busy changing diapers. Or too busy going to work to earn a living to support them. And then you ask, well, can't you support your kids through the dana you earn as a Dharma teacher? Well, if I did that, then I'm only going to be going certain places where I know I'm going to get a certain income, because I have to support my kids in a certain way so that they have everything their friends have. Because if my kids don't have everything their friends have, you know, what kind of parent am I? And then also my kids are going to complain to me. So then I can't go teach anybody I want to. I only have to teach the places where I'm going to get enough money to support my kids. You know, with the mortgage and the cars and the, you know, the summer camp and the whole nine yards. Okay. So, and then if I'm busy taking care of my family, or I'm busy working, you know, to earn the money to take care of my family, because I may have this grandiose idea of this romantic relationship, and, you know, it's all very good and wonderful, and you have a couple of kids, and then he walks out the door, you know, or you walk out the door because you can't stand the guy anymore, and then you're single parenting, and then how much time do you have? So forget about teaching the Dharma. It's difficult even to practice the Dharma, isn't it? So there's all this talk about practicing Dharma in your daily life. Put the Dharma into practice in your daily life. Yes, and it sounds great, but if you don't have any quiet time to think about the Dharma, how are you going to ever put it into practice in your life when it's not quiet and, you know, peaceful? Okay, so we need that quiet time to be able to really work on our mind, to be able to start to understand the Dharma, so we have something to try and put in practice when our senses are active and we're doing things. Yeah, so if you don't have that time as a layperson, because a layperson, very busy lives, you know, I mean, you can see it, very busy lives. And Dharma is just one among many activities. I mean, even you get to the Dharma, it's difficult to practice, you know, because you're sitting in the Dharma center and you've turned off your cell phone, but you can feel it vibrating, you know. And so every few minutes, it's boom, boom, boom. And you're seeing the number, oh, I've got to call that person back, I've got to call that person back, I've got to call that person, you know. And how many, you know, and then how many of these phone calls are going to be nice? Because most of them are going to be from your boss. You know? We have a deadline to meet, and you aren't in the office working overtime for no pay, which is what you're expected to do nowadays. Okay? So I just look at lay life, and, you know, if you have the values of wanting to attain liberation and enlightenment, lay life is incredibly difficult. Yeah. It's true, isn't it? No time, very little time to practice. You got to take care of your family. And His Holiness always says, and it's so cute the way His Holiness says it, you know, if you don't have children, then you're all upset because you don't have children. Now and then you're trying this and that and the other thing to have kids. And then when you have kids, then you're upset because your kids aren't doing what you want them to do. And you're upset because they aren't studying what you want them to do, want them to study, and they aren't acting the way you want them to study. And, you know, and then you raise them and you sacrifice everything for them. And in the back of your mind, you're hoping that they'll do something nice for you when they're old. And they just say, forget you, Mom and Dad. You know, I'm off doing what I want to do. Yeah. So, you know, I think quite difficult living a lay life. Yeah, if you're interested in spiritual practice. Okay, so I think, you know, taking precepts is very helpful for living an ethical life. And I think it's important to understand that monastic life isn't just taking precepts, okay? Because you can take the five precepts as a layperson. So, you know, there's no pervasion that to keep ethical conduct you have to be a monastic. It's just, I think it's easier. And there's no pervasion that if you're a monastic, the only thing is keeping the precepts. No. Okay, because monasticism is a whole way of life. Okay, it's a whole way of thinking. It's a whole way of being in the world. The precepts set the foundation and the ground rules, so to speak. But to keep your precepts, you know, involves a certain lifestyle. It involves a certain way of thinking. It involves really looking at your mind. Okay, because the precepts aren't just do this and don't do that, you know, because if you look at them as do's and don'ts, then you're going to be really miserable as a monastic, you know, because you can't do this and can't do that and can't do the other thing. So you have to really look at all those actions and realize I don't want to do them. And so my precepts are protecting me from not doing what I don't want to do. Okay, they're incredible protection from, you know, keeping us from not doing what we don't really want to do. Okay? But to keep the precepts, we have to work with our mind. So even though the pratimoksha precepts, you know, which are the category of precepts of the monastic vows, even though they involve directly governing our verbal and physical actions, in order to be able to keep them, we have to look at the mind, because the mind is the source of our actions. We don't act automatically. We act with intention, and the intention comes from the mind. Okay? So the vows have to do with specific physical and verbal behavior, but to keep them involves turning the mirror on and looking at the mind. Okay. And to really keep the vows, it involves living in a community. It involves having a certain kind of environment. Okay. So the question came up yesterday about people who take vows and then live in the city and continue to work. Yeah. And you see some monastics doing that. I do not recommend that for a number of reasons. First of all, actually in the Vinaya, you're supposed to stay with your spiritual mentor for at least 5 years after you're ordained. So if you go back to work right away, you're not doing that. If you don't have the training that comes in those first 5 years, you don't even know what your precepts are. So you could be breaking them all the time and not even, you know, knowing it. And if you don't stay close to your teacher and to a supportive community, there's no support for your swimming upstream. Yeah. So you might say, okay, well, I'll go to work and I'll put on lay clothes because I go to work because I can't wear my robes to work. Got to grow my hair out a little bit because I can't go to work shaved, you know. So then you do that. So then what happens at work? Well, there's some nice, attractive person who has no idea that you're a monastic, and they find you attractive. And how are you going to handle that situation? Difficult, isn't it? It's going to be very difficult. If you have attachment in your mind and they have attachment in their mind, and you're going to say, sorry, I'm celibate, you know? When you have attachment in the mind, you're not going to say, sorry, I'm celibate. You're going to say, oh. Okay. So it's very difficult. And so even if you don't get involved in that, then you say, okay, well, I'll go to work like that. Then I'll come home and I'll put my robes on at home. Yeah. Well, you come home from work and you're exhausted. Yeah. Do you feel like meditating after working 8 hours? Which is the least amount you can work these days. Yeah, probably you've worked 9 or 10. You come home. Are you fresh and ready to go and ready to meditate? No. What do you want to do? You want to relax. What is our normal behavior when we want to relax? Huh? Okay, that's your, he collapses anywhere, it doesn't matter. He just lies down and goes to sleep. You'll find him when you're trying to walk places. And he's there asleep. Okay, for other people, how do they handle it when they want to relax? You know, they drink and drug. Okay, how do other people handle it? They turn on the television. And eat. We try to take refuge in the refrigerator. Okay? So other people, you handle stress, tension, you want to relax, you eat. Yeah? Or some people go to the shopping center and buy something. Or you go out dancing. Or you go, you know, you go out with friends. Or you surf the internet. Now, do you feel like sitting down and meditating? After you've been working 8 or 9 hours? Forget it. I want to relax. Now, of course, we don't realize that the things we do to relax only increase our ignorance, anger, and attachment. And we don't realize that because we haven't meditated enough, and we haven't meditated enough because we've been too busy doing those things. Okay? So you see how you're totally stuck? Yeah. Very, very difficult. Okay? So, you know, people say, oh, well, I'll go to work and get a job, and then I'll go home and put on my robes, and I'll be a monk or nun. I think quite difficult. You know, quite difficult. I'll have a television because I've got to watch the news to keep up with what's going on. And you wind up watching all the soap operas, you know, or whatever. Okay. So I think it's very, very difficult. So I strongly, you know, I don't think it's good to live in that kind of situation. Now, having said that, I have a friend who is a nun, who's a university professor, who lives on her own. But she's also been a nun over 30 years. And she's also disciplined, and she also spent many, many years living, you know, in a monastic type environment. Okay. But for new monastics, forget it. You know, the majority of them who live like that wind up giving back their vows because they don't have the joys of lay life, and they don't have the satisfaction of living a monastic life either. Second Rinpoche used to call living like that being like a bat. Okay? So when somebody's hunting mice, the bat says, "I'm not a mouse, I'm not a mouse, I'm a bird." And when somebody's hunting birds, the bat says, "I'm not a bird, I'm not a bird, I'm a mouse." So that's what it's like when you try and live as a layperson when you're Sangha. You know, it's like you're always trying to, you know, do one with then finagle the other, or say I'm, you know, when you want to live as a Sangha, then you say I'm not a layperson, but when you want to live as a layperson, then you forget being a Sangha. And, you know, it gets really quite difficult. Yeah, so I really don't recommend that. And also, I think that there is, when you are Sangha and when you live in a community, the community has a certain symbolic thing for people, you know. I mean, a monastery is a place where people know they can come and receive spiritual guidance and do spiritual practice. If you live alone in an apartment and your apartment looks like everybody else's apartments except you have more Buddha pictures, people are not going to think of your apartment, you know, as you're going to accumulate a lot of stuff, yeah, which in a monastery you can't. Yeah, but in lay life you can, you know, if you live on your own, you just fill your apartment with stuff. People are not going to think of your place as a place to go for spiritual guidance and practice. Whereas if you were part of a monastery, the monastery has that certain magnetic power. It represents something to people. And we sometimes get these incredible letters from other people telling us what it means to them that Srivasti Abbey exists. And even though they're in the middle of whatever they're living, in the middle of whatever city, just knowing that the Abbey exists is such a refuge and something that brings them so much solace and optimism in their life. Yeah. So if you're able to live as part of a community that, you know, gives that energy to society, then just by living your life, it's becoming something that is meaningful to other people. Yeah. And I also think that living as a monastic and monasteries in general are kind of the conscience of society. Yeah. It's like I was saying before, if you're a layperson, you do whatever you want. Nobody cares, you know, unless you get caught. But as a monastic, you know, with your sense of integrity, your consideration for others, you know, your firm belief in ethical conduct, then it's a challenge to society's norms. It's a conscience for society. Yeah. So our society is totally involved in consumerism. And here's a monastery where we are desperately trying not to consume. You know, we wind up getting all sorts of different things, but it's for the purpose of propagating the Dharma. But we really try and set limits on what we consume, you know, and what we get. And so, you know, we don't just go into town and that looks nice in a store and buy it. Or I feel like having this, you know, go out and buy it. Or, you know, I want a new whatever it is, because the old one is old fashioned. So I'm going to go out and buy it. So you don't do that. So that, just your, the way you're living, is acting as a conscience for this consumer society where people have no regret about taking more than their fair share of the world's resources and exploiting the planet and destroying environments. You know, when you live in this kind of thing, you know, we only drive to town when we need to. And you can see what a constant fight that is and how I am always on everybody's back about that. Well, they're sitting there saying, but I have to go to town today because I forgot the nails yesterday when I went to town, you know, or whatever it is. Okay. And so really being more mindful of our consumption, cutting back on that. So, and in so many ways we act as a conscience for society. So, if you live on your own as a monastic, then you miss out on being a part of that community that has that meaning for other people. Okay, so I didn't actually get to the part in here. I was going to talk about the benefits of the precepts. But maybe we'll do that tomorrow. But maybe you have some questions, comments?
The important part of the importance of monastic in general is that being the ones that are the most committed to the Dharma, they strive to actualize and practice it and transmit it forward. Because actually all we know now is due to the kindness and efforts and of so and everything. So actually I find that that really makes my head.
Yeah.
Very important responsibility. Because even if you, I mean, a word or a meaning that's not transmitted and everything goes down.
Yeah.
That's not inherently.
Yeah, and so you're saying that, that the role of the monastics has traditionally been to study, learn, and practice the Dharma, and to transmit it to future generations. And what a big responsibility that is, because if even one word gets left out, it can change the whole meaning of the teaching. Yeah, and so it's a huge responsibility to do that. And you said it makes your hair stand on end when you really think of the value and benefit that that brings. Yeah, quite definitely. Quite definitely. And so although lay people may teach and transmit the Dharma in that way, you know, there isn't the physical place where people associate with that. And also, again, you know, if when you have a community and everybody's studying, if what you teach, you slip up, other people in the community are going to notice it and they're going to correct you. If you're living on your own and the only people around you are people who know less than you, they're not necessarily going to notice that you slipped up, you know, whether you just did so out of your own ignorance or whatever. And so as a way of transmitting the Dharma, the force of the community that way is quite powerful. Because people will question, you know, what you're teaching. Yeah?
Two questions. Mm-hmm. The first question is relating to the fact that when you put on rope, we are like the symbol for people to be mindful about our behavior. So if we are new monastic, and we don't have that much confidence that we can be a role model, but if put on rope, the danger for me, I think, would be if you didn't live up to it, then you're actually bringing Buddhism down. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Other people will see differently, like, you are monastic, why are you not behaving? But you're practitioners, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not there yet, right? But they won't understand this. So you're also giving them the wrong impression.
Mm-hmm. Let me respond to one question at a time, okay? Mm-hmm. So you're saying that if you take vows and put on robes and then you don't keep your precepts properly, then you're actually disillusioning other people and bringing down Buddhism in the eyes of other people. And that's true, you know. And that's why it's very important to receive monastic training. Yeah, and not just put on your robes and go live in a city where you don't have any monastic training. And that's why it's important to live in the community and to live near a teacher so that you get that training, you know. Because when, you know, living in the community, you're daily getting that training and you're learning it and it's becoming part of you. And you take that with you when you leave the community, hopefully. In other words, you shouldn't be acting one way in the community and another way outside. Yeah, you should be training your mind and keeping your precepts so that wherever you are, you're acting according to them. And so, you know, people know when you're a young monastic, you know that you're not going to be perfect, but they rejoice in your trying to be. So you don't want to get so paranoid about, you know, oh, I'm doing all this stuff, everybody's, you know, I'm taking my precepts, hey, number one, perfect, I'm destroying the Dharma, you know. You don't want to get paranoid and fanatic about this. Yeah, I mean, because I think people have, if they know that you're young and you're training, that they understand that. But you also put yourself in a good situation so that you can keep your precepts well and so that you can learn them well.
Yeah. My second question is relating to the fact that you were comparing the difference between trying to be good between a lay person and a monastic. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering whether you can offer insight on a comparison between
Okay, so I was comparing just an ordinary lay person with a monastic. What about a lay Buddhist practitioner versus a Buddhist monastic? Still, I think being a lay practitioner and keeping the five precepts is really excellent and very good. But I also think that it is a more difficult way to practice. Buddhism definitely needs strong lay practitioners. You know, historically, there's always been very strong lay practitioners. And I think lay practitioners can be very helpful to the Dharma in the sense that as new people come and become Buddhists, the lay practitioners can help answer their questions and show an example of ethical behavior and teach them the etiquette that they need to live in a Buddhist kind of environment. So I think strong lay practitioners are very good and much needed for the spread of the Dharma. But if you have the ability to become a monastic, you know, and you have the yearning to do that, I think that that's much better for the existence of the Dharma and for the amount of benefit you can do for sentient beings. Yeah. So I'm not saying lay people don't benefit sentient beings, and I'm not saying monastics are superior. Okay, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying if you're a monastic, you should go around with your nose in the air saying I'm superior to everybody else, because if you do that, you do not have a monastic mind. Okay? And it's just showing, your lack of training is showing. Okay? So I'm not doing some kind of hierarchical trip, but I'm just talking practically minded, you know, that if you have the ability to keep the precepts and live that kind of life, then I think it's an easier way to practice, and it is a way to have a stronger impact for the good of the Dharma. We got both your questions? Okay. Yeah?
So when you think about a scholastic education in like a modern university.
Okay. So what do I think of a scholastic education in a modern university? I think that you can learn a lot, and you can learn a lot of information in a modern university. But becoming a Dharma practitioner is more than learning information. First of all, if you study in a university, you don't know if your teacher is Buddhist or not. If you're studying Buddhist doctrine, being taught by somebody who's not Buddhist, you're not sure if you're going to get the right interpretation of things. Okay, so you could be learning what you think is Buddhism, but it's not Buddhism. Okay. Second of all, even if your teacher is a is a Buddhist. The whole thing in a university, your mind is geared towards getting grades to get your diploma to go get a job. So your goal isn't necessarily to become enlightened. It may also be to become enlightened, but it's also practically minded to get a job. Okay? So it's, you know, how that works with your motivation is different. And then third is the relationship with the teacher is completely different. You know? Because your scholastic teacher just looks at, you know, do you write your papers well, and do you tell them what they already know, and because that's what you do in papers and exams, is tell the teacher what they already know, and you know, you graduate and the relationship is over, and whereas a relationship with your spiritual mentor is a totally different ballgame and happens on a very, very different level, you know. And because that your spiritual mentor is looking out for your spiritual well-being and is committed to helping you until you attain enlightenment. Whereas your scholastic teacher is looking out for your academic grades and is committed to helping you as long as you take their class. So it's a very different kind of relationship. Yeah. Very, very different. And I think that the role of a spiritual mentor in our practice is really crucial in being able to practice long term.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that it's ideal to spend 5 years at least with your teacher
when you're
ordained.
Is that
a precept?
Is the 5 years a precept?
Yes.
Okay. You look nervous. Okay. The way it is, it's a little bit different for men and women. Yeah. For the women, when they take the novice vows and the Shikshamana vows, they have 2 years of training, and then it is a precept to stay near your preceptor for 2 years after your full ordination. Okay. For the men, it's just stay with your preceptor for 5 years. And that's usually from the time you take your full ordination. But then the men don't necessarily have to wait the 2 years to take the full ordination. This is standard Vinaya. How we're doing things at the Abbey is different, which is that the men and women both are going to wait 2 years before they take the full ordination.
So then my question is...
Yeah.
There's many people who are ordained people, and maybe their teachers live in Tibet, so the teachers come to North America and ordain them, and the teacher leaves, and that's tragic. Or their teacher's in India, and they're still not with their teacher for 9 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you bring up a very good point that the way it is now that, you know, sometimes teachers come here, they ordain people, they go back to India or to Tibet, and then the person sitting here going, what do I do? This is one of the reasons. So one of the reasons I started the Abbey is to try and do something to remedy that situation. And also, it's, you know, I think the attitude, the Chinese and the Theravadas don't do that very much. If they ordain somebody, the expectation is you come and live in the monastery. It's mainly in the Tibetan tradition that that happens, because the Tibetan monks' main concern is their monasteries in India and Tibet. And so if a Westerner wants to ordain, or somebody non-Tibetan wants to ordain, that's fine. They assume that that person has their own money, which is not always the case. And they give that disciple a lot more freedom, because for a number of reasons, I think maybe because the person hasn't been doesn't really know what they're getting into very much, very well. You know, so you have a number of people who don't really understand monastic life very well, running off to get ordained, thinking that, you know, they just continue living as normal, as usual, and they haven't received adequate preparation or adequate training or adequate screening before they've ordained. And the masters are actually, in Vinaya, you're supposed to take care of the disciples that you ordain, but they feel that their primary interest is their Tibetan disciples. And so it's often a very, very difficult situation, you know, not one that's highly recommended, but one that you see far too often. And I know some monastics, you know, teacher came, ordained them here in America, and then they stay in America, and there's a Dharma center that they go to, but they live in the city, but the Dharma, they're the only monastic in the Dharma center. The people in the Dharma center say, who are you? Maybe they'll give them a seat in the front row, but, you know, other than that, they don't have any other consideration or support for that person. They have to support themselves financially. Very difficult to keep your vows if you're working. Yeah, and it's really quite a difficult situation for people. I know a number of people in that kind of situation. Yeah. So I, you know, the many of the Tibetans, their viewpoint is, because you see, if you understand their culture, yeah, in old Tibet, a quarter of the male population was ordained. And ordination was the way to get an education. They didn't have a secular system of education. Or if they did, it was only for the very top class elite people. So if you wanted any kind of education at all, you had to ordain. Then second thing is, they ordained when they were little kids. And so the philosophy is, you ordain as many people as possible, and then you'll get some good ones out of that. Because when they're little, you don't know what they're going to grow up to be like. Everybody has that potential. Ordain them all. If they disrobe when they're teenagers, it's okay, because at least they had the good, you know, they accumulated some good karma when they were monastics as children. They learned some dharma. They're going out to society. They're a little bit calmer and better people than they would be if they hadn't been monastics as kids. And then they say it's better to be ordained one day in this degenerate age than to be ordained your entire life at the time of the Buddha. So if you want to get ordained, come. If you create some good karma, if you are disrobe later, it's no big deal, because at least you have that good imprint that comes from being ordained as long as you did. So I completely understand that way of thinking. And if, you know, you live in a culture where there's no secular education, and the monasteries are very well established, and the society already respects the monastics very well, and so if 100 or 200 disrobe when they're teenagers, it doesn't matter because you have a few thousand more, you know, then I can understand that way of thinking and that way of acting. However, in the West, Buddhism is new, and what Western lay people think about Buddhism is going to depend a lot on how Western monastics act. And if people don't receive proper training before they ordain and after they ordain, and if it's just come one and come all, what I've seen happen is that many people with psychological problems ordain. And then afterwards, I mean, I remember seeing one person with a shemmed up, hiked up, you know, kind of almost to the knee, smoking a cigarette in the street of McLeod Gond. You know, people who are mentally ill, you know, and the lamas speak Tibetan. They can't discern these people, you know, and they don't know Western life what's normal behavior and what's not normal behavior. So here's somebody who requests ordination, and it's such good karma for them, and ordain them, and I'm not supporting them physically, and they're here, and they can fend for themselves, and so that's what happens. And then you have people who don't act properly, you know, some of people have mental problems. Some people have very good intentions, but they don't get the training. Yeah, and then they say, oh, the lay people don't support us, but they don't realize, why don't the lay people support you? Well, look at how you're acting. You know? Yeah. So it's really, it can be quite confusing for people. So that's why I really strongly recommend that you go to a monastery and you stay near a teacher and you get trained. And before you ordain, you set up a situation so that you know you're going to have a good situation to live in afterwards. Because some people have what I call ordination fever. It means I want to get ordained ASAP, and they're looking to the day they get ordained. You know, I want to get ordained. I got to get that day when I get ordained. But to look the day beyond their ordination, they haven't gone that far. Like, you get ordained, and everybody congratulates you, and you get a lot of papas, and what are you going to do the next day? Where are you going to live? What are you going to study? How are you going to train your mind? How are you going to learn the precepts? And they haven't thought about it, because they just want to get ordained. Okay? So that's why, programs, I think, like EML are so important. Yeah. Yeah, and now they're doing a program in India for about a week, I think, maybe 10 days. They extended it to at Tushita before His Holiness will ordain Westerners. And the private office has also gotten tighter about who they'll ordain and who not. Yeah. So otherwise, it's just really, you know, it's not fair to everybody, I think. It's my opinion.
When I was 20, I really wanted to be pregnant. I was studying midwifery, and I'd done some labor support, and I really wanted to be pregnant. And then I got pregnant, and then I thought, this means raising a child.
Exactly. You just look until that thing and not the next what happens as a result. Yeah. Right.
I was talking to somebody about this, and I wasn't sure what the right answer would be, but it's not really something on my mind, but it's just a question. Is somebody suggested that actually you create negative karma by disrobing? Would that be appropriate?
Well, it's certainly, okay, so do you create negative karma by disrobing? It's certainly not possible. And in my experience, almost everybody who I know who is disrobed is because of an overpowering of afflictions in their mind. Now, if you've disrobed because, like I could understand in the communist takeover of China and Tibet, when people were forced to disrobe, or when they had to do that to save their lives or whatever, that kind of thing, I think, is another situation. But I think most of the people nowadays that I know, it's because it's usually affliction. Yeah. And the affliction that's most powerful is sexual attraction. Yeah, because no, I haven't heard anybody say, I'm disrobing because I want to go kill somebody. I haven't heard anybody say that. You know, sometimes people say living with a financial insecurity is difficult, so they disrobe for that reason, you know. But it's usually, yeah, that they're feeling lonely and they're feeling unloved, you know, and a lot of that comes because if you're not living in a community, feeling lonely, you're feeling unloved, you're kind of horny, you know. So that's the one that usually gets people.
I thought when we have gone to the two monastic gatherings with Montana, I really think that the people that live in communities seem happier.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely better trained.
Yeah. So you've been able to see for yourself. that when you've gone to the monastic gatherings, that the people who are better trained are ones who live in the community, and the people who are just happier as monastics are ones who live in a community. Yeah, definitely, because it can be kind of chaotic otherwise.
But, and you know, it's, you could, the community or the community, if you, you know what I mean?
And yeah, okay. So how do you know if you and the community get married?
Yeah.
Okay. You live together first. Okay, so for example, at the Abbey, that's why, you know, when people come here, they don't come in as instant members of the community. They come in on trial period, so that they have a period of time to see if the community fits them, and the community has some time to see if they fit the community. Yeah, and so then it's a trial period, and then if, you know, everybody says, you know, you're very nice, but we don't want to get married, then it's okay. You know, there's no hard feelings in there. Okay?
But the community in anywhere is not static, it changes. So even if you find that it sticks around, it will change anyway, right?
Yeah. Okay, so that's very true. Community is always changing. Yeah, sure. You know, people come, people go. You know, there's more or less people and everything, so the community's always changing. But it's similar when you get married, the person you marry is always changing and you're always changing. Yeah? And so the thing that I appreciate about Buddhist monasticism, unlike Catholic monasticism, is that you can do different things at different times in your practice. And so there's some people, like many of Venerable William's disciples, in the early years they live in the main monastery and they get trained. And then after that, you know, some of them have gone to graduate school, or some of them have gone to study with this master or that master, or do this or do that. So the thing is, you know, once you have a basis of good training, you know, then if your master is, you know, sees that you will benefit more from, you know, studying with somebody else or living in a different environment or doing a different kind of work, they'll send you off to do that.
Can it also be a little dangerous though if you marry your sangha and you realize that you did that more than you married the dharma, because if they break apart continually, it's
okay.
You can't use it also.
Yeah, so can it be dangerous if you marry the sangha without really marrying the dharma? Oh, definitely. Definitely. You know, so if somebody's just looking for a place to live, and this is a nice place to live, but they're not that interested in the dharma, then it's not really appropriate to accept them as, you know, as part of the community. And it's also not good for them. Yeah? And so I think that's part of what the trial period is about, is not only seeing their relationship with the particular community, but how they relate to the Dharma. And that's why I really firmly believe in people keeping the 8 precepts for a period of time before they take the monastic ordination, because it gives you the ability to kind of, you know, wear a uniform and shave your head and live like a monastic, but you don't have that entire lifelong commitment. And so if in the process of doing that you realize, well, this isn't for me, then, you know, you can dedicate your merit and leave and not feel bad, you know, because you've committed yourself to something and then you're retracting. Yeah. So that's why I really advocate this period of living with 8 precepts. Okay, this will be the last question.
I'm just curious, choosing the person to bestow ordination, the criteria, is it the same as the one that we choose
a
spiritual teacher according to the
Dharma? Oh, okay. So the criteria of choosing your ordination master and the criteria of choosing your Lamrim teacher, are they the same? Not necessarily, okay? Because there's 3 levels of teachers. There's your Vinaya teacher, your Bodhisattva teacher, and your Tantric teacher. And so there's different levels of qualifications for each of those. And And so you may have one person that's all three, or you may have three different people, or you may have many people who teach you the Bodhisattva path, or many people who are your Tantric master. So there's, you know, some things in there. What you see, sometimes people will study with one person, but they will be sent to somebody else to take the ordination. You know, because having an ordination, it's actually quite difficult to have an ordination. It requires a lot of people, and there's certain expense, and especially the full ordination where you need more people to attend. So very often then people will be sent to a main place to receive ordination in a large group, you know, by a well-known teacher. So it depends really very much on the situation of the person. Okay, so let's sit quietly for a couple of minutes and take all this in. And please, in the future, you know, you can ask more questions about anything I said. With all of its stuff in it,